Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting. Eerie.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within the group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
Guilty. I wouldn't do anything that I felt guilty about.
You don't feel guilty at all?
There's no need to feel guilty. I haven't done anything I'm ashamed of. Maybe I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that, for not doing enough, for not giving enough, for not being more perceptive, for not being aware enough. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then when I felt like I really offered society something. You know, if I wanted to kill somebody, I'd take this book and beat you to death with it, and I wouldn't feel a thing. It'd be just like walking to the drugstore.
This is Charles Manson, one of America's most famous serial killers. Charles Manson was showing violent behavior from a very young age. But what made him a killer? Was it biology and lack of brain function in certain parts of the brain? Or is it all to blame on the environment he grew up in?
Do you feel blame? Are you mad? Do you feel like
this episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast is about what makes a murderer and how we can understand violent and psychopathic behavior from a biological perspective. If killing can't be associated with biological brain functions and dysfunctions, can we then firstly detect predispositions for violent behavior? Secondly, can we treat them? And at last, can we blame it all on the violent offender? Those are questions Adrian Rain raised at his talk at the Science and Cocktails event in the concert hall at the Danish Broadcasting Corporation in Copenhagen. And that's where we are.
Thank you very much. I mean, I feel at home already. You're such a warm and gracious audience. I think we may have a bit of fun tonight. Whether you'll be applauding me by the time I finish with you in 45 minutes, I'm not so sure about that. But let's see how it goes now. As you see, I'm going to take you on a submarine going down. Beneath the surface, because on the surface, we don't know what makes a psychopathic killer. How early are the seeds of violence sown? How early in life do we have this predisposition for murderous psychopathic behavior? Are the brains of murderers really different to the rest of us or not? Are they just the same? And what does this body of knowledge mean for us in society? And in particular, I want to go to three specific societal issues. What does it mean for our ability to predict amongst us who is at risk for becoming a violent offender? Secondly, what can we do to prevent murderous violent behavior? And thirdly, what about punishment? What does this body of knowledge say for how we dispose of violent criminal offenders?
Adrian Raine has studied the underlying reasons and predispositions for violent behavior for centuries, and he has a long list of interesting findings. We'll get much more into his research, but first we'll get to know a bit more about the man, Adrian Raine, and how he got on the track of what makes a murderer. I was lucky to meet him for a chat at the hotel where he was staying in Copenhagen.
Yes, my name is Adrian Raine. I'm the Richard Perry University Professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm in the departments of psychiatry, criminology, and psychology.
How did you become interested in the question about what makes a murderer?
I think it's a question that we're all fascinated in, really, but it sort of goes back to when I was an undergraduate and at Oxford University, and you know, every week we had to write essays. You know, lectures were optional, would you believe? But every week we had to write two essays. And at the end of my 3 years, somebody said, oh, you should do a PhD. And I thought to myself, well, what on earth will I do it in? So I looked back at all the essays I'd written, and it turned out I'd written a good one on the biological basis of psychopaths. So there you have it. I mean, and so that led me into, getting involved in research on crime and violence. And of course, homicide is right at the top of, you know, the iceberg of crime. I mean, you can't climb higher than taking somebody's life. And so I think that intrigues us all. And that's essentially how I got to do what I'm doing now. Basically, it all started a long, long time ago when I was a little undergraduate. Now, was that long enough?
That was, but I think this is perfect. It can also be longer, but
fine.
It is also like a geeky podcast. So,
because I could go on forever with that question. I could go. Well, you know, and then what I did, and then how I couldn't get a job, and how I ended up in prison for 4 years, and
I would love to hear that story.
So I got to do a PhD at York University in England. I studied antisocial behaviour in school kids, because nobody had looked at that time at the biology of antisocial behaviour in plain old school kids. People had looked at crazy psychopaths, but not normal kids. So that was lovely. I had 3 wonderful years at York. But then, even though I'd published quite a bit, I just couldn't get a job, you know. And the only place that would take me was prison. So I ended up spending 4 years in prison, 2 top security prisons in England. And, it wasn't easy, because although the prison experience was a great experience for me, I wanted an academic job. Of course, if you do a PhD, you want an academic job. But in those 4 years, I applied for 67 jobs, and I got 67 straight rejections. You know, I don't mean to brag, but I think I'm only the only tenured professor who was rejected by Papua New Guinea. I mean, I would have gone there if they'd offered me the job. No chance. And it was only on the 68th application that I hit lucky and I got a job at Nottingham University. Otherwise, I would still be in prison now.
What were you doing in prison?
In prison, I was doing work with prisoners. I was a prison psychologist, and my job was to give them treatment, help them, you know, because some of them get depressed, some get anxious. So I was trying to help them with therapy, cognitive behavior therapy and psychotherapy and relaxation training I used to do with them. I would also have to assess every new prisoner that came into the prison, and that gave me a lot of experience actually in assessing psychopathy. Because the year I started working in prison, this amazing instrument, the psychopathy checklist, was published. And I saw it, I thought, wow, I should use that in the prison. So I got a lot of experience in assessing psychopathy, but also in dealing and working with murderers, rapists, paedophiles, psychopaths. Yeah, that was a lot of my job. I also did work on training courses for hostage taking. You know, if a hostage is taken, you know, what do you do? How do you talk them out of it? So, you know, I did training courses in that too.
Okay, wow, that's really interesting. So you have a lot of experience, actually. You're not just an academic.
Well, it's sometimes experience which, you know, it's the dark side, isn't it? You know, because I think one of the hardest things I did in the prison was working with paedophiles. You know, the female prison psychologist didn't want to have to deal with them, so I, Muggins here, had to deal with them. And it's difficult because, you know, we all dislike paedophilia, the thought of it, and the innocent children who were hurt by that. And it was hard for me to go and sit and listen and understand the thoughts and feelings of a paedophile and even talking to them about their offences. But it was interesting because I got to understand them a bit more. And although this might sound outrageous to you, I think I found some paedophiles, not all, but some of them, loved children too much, cared for them also too much. There were some paedophiles that were pretty horrible, nasty, psychopathic paedophiles who wouldn't care for anyone, but I think some of them really had a genuine care and feeling for those children. Of course, they were also very disturbed in what they did. But I think the whole experience did give me interesting insights, not just into paedophilia, but also psychopathy and homicide.
Okay, now that you both got like your experience, you've been talking to all these criminals, and you also like in your research, you see what are the like brain damage can make you violent, and you got such a nuanced picture of what makes a criminal now. So like for us, maybe like if you're a murderer, we see them just as a monster or just like this person is bad. So did you learn through your experience and your work to see the person more like nuanced?
You are absolutely right, because I think, you know, we all have this stereotype, this picture of the devil incarnate as the murderer or the rapist or the psychopath. But honestly, they are people like me and you. And, you know, when you work with them, you get to realize they are, you know, 99% of the time, they are actually just like me and you. It's only that 1% of the time that they go out of limb and do something really crazy. And it's sort of really quite fascinating how normal many of them were. I know that sounds odd, but honestly, if you worked with them too and got to know them, it's just like speaking to a colleague, almost sometimes a friend. And, you know, some of the individuals there I really got to know and almost got to care for. Never forget one psychopath called Andy Mayer. He was the nicest person I've ever met in prison, and I loved working with him, and I helped him as much as I could, and helped his common law wife, who was visiting him with their child, and I'd give his wife and daughter a lift back in my car to the railway station. So it's surprising how, on the one hand, ooh, you know, a horrible murderer, but they are people and you can connect with them if you only try.
But this guy, he was a psychopath. So was he able to care for you or for his wife and his child? Did he have emotions?
Yeah, it's hard to say because he was only in prison, and of course he would talk about love and the care and thinking about his wife and child. But how can you really know that somebody really cares if they are not out in society where we can test, do they love someone? Because, you know, when you love someone, you do things for that person. And I couldn't test that proposition, of course. I mean, yes, he loved them visiting and he wrote to them, but he's got nothing else to do. You know, if he was on the outside, would he be a responsible parent? I just don't know. I just don't know.
So he might have been a better father on the inside.
Paradoxically, he might have been. Maybe he wrote more letters and communicated more than he might have done on the outside. I think it is true. I mean, it certainly is true that people serving a life sentence, it gets them thinking. And in a strange way, maybe they've got a lot more time to connect with people and to think about their relationships than perhaps on the outside.
Okay, so they go also, they have the possibility to really go through deep personal developments.
Yes and no. I mean, having said, yeah, you know, they've got time to think about it. I mean, whether it does them any good, I just don't know, because, you know, recidivism, it's like a revolving door, especially with psychopaths, because they don't change, you know. So they're in prison, they serve the sentence, they come out, they may last a few months. I mean, of course it varies, some will last longer, but they tend to go back, you know. They don't seem to learn from experience. That's one of a key feature of the psychopath. So although I say, yes, they've got lots of time to reflect, and this is the old idea of solitary confinement, that you give the person time to reflect on themselves, but honestly, that hasn't worked, unfortunately.
Adrian Raine has studied how predispositions for violent behavior is created from the very beginning of life.
We assess birth complications at the time of birth because we think birth complications like anoxia, lack of oxygen, can damage the fetal brain and potentially give rise to future violence. We also, when the babies were aged 1 year, we had social workers visit their homes, and we were trying to measure maternal rejection of the child. What was that? Well, first of all, the mum didn't want the pregnancy. Secondly, she made an attempt to abort the fetus, but failed. These are live male births. And thirdly, the child was separated from the mum, for whatever reason, for at least 3 months in the first year of life. Okay, so we have on the one hand the biological risk factor, the birth complications. On the other hand, the environmental risk factor, negative parenting. We followed up the babies for 18 years and looked to see which ones were violent.
The study showed that lack of oxygen at birth in relation to maternal neglect had an increasing effect on the development of violent behavior later in the child's life.
There was a threefold increase in violence in that group with both the birth complications and the maternal early rejection of the child. So I think one heuristic message I want to give you tonight is that it's not simple. It's not just the environment. It's not just biology and brain factors. It's especially when we get both of these coming together, that's when we get a toxic mix that can raise the odds threefold of somebody growing up to become a violent criminal offender. And by the way, those findings are controlling for a lot of background social factors. Okay, so nobody's born bad, but can a bad birth predispose to violence? In a way, it can. What else? What else early on in life?
Adrian Raine continues presenting results showing how bad nutrition, as well as smoking and drinking during pregnancy, is associated with the child developing violent behavior later in life. Because both nutrition, smoking, and drinking during pregnancy affects the development of a child's brain.
So that's the beginning, earlier risk factors that raise the odds of people becoming violent. This also raises another question. I want you to take a close look at this baby, and we can ask ourselves a number of questions. Does this baby have fetal alcohol syndrome? Yes, it does. You can see it in its face. Is this baby more likely to grow up and become a criminal offender? Violent offender? Yes, it is. We've seen the data. Is this baby responsible for the fact that its mom took alcohol during pregnancy? I hear you say it. No, it's not. Will we hold this baby responsible for its crimes? Yes, we will. My question to you is that justice? Is that your idea of justice? Because it's not mine.
Knowing that early life risk factors has such a large influence on the development of violent behavior because of the biological development of the brain doesn't only change the understanding of justice for violent criminals, but it also put new perspectives to the treatment of criminals. I ask Adrian Rain about his ideas about how to treat criminals.
I've taken a biological approach to trying to understand crime and violence, not to ignore the social factors that are clearly involved in crime also. But biology has been ignored, and I think it's half of the equation. You know, we've only been looking at one side of the coin, the social side, like child abuse, poor homes, bad neighborhoods. And of course, that's important. But there is another side, and that's the biological factors that go also to shape crime and violence. So I think in treating and intervening, we have to address both sides of the coin.
Before we get more into the biological interventions Adrian Rain proposes, we need to know some more about how the brain of violent criminals differ from other brains.
My first academic job was in England, but I emigrated to the United States. And one of the reasons for that is that in England, I couldn't get a lot of murderers together to put in a brain scanner. But in Los Angeles, there's loads of murderers wandering around. And so what I could do is take 41 murderers, put them in a brain scanner, match them carefully to 41 controls, and compare their brains. So this is what I found. Let me orient you here. You're looking down on the brain. You've got a bird's eye view. The red and yellow colors indicate high glucose metabolism or high brain functioning. And the cool colors, blue, green, indicate low brain function.
The brain scans clearly showed a downregulated function of the prefrontal cortex of the killers. Because the prefrontal cortex is related to emotional control and behavior regulations, it makes sense that lower activity in this part of the brain can be associated with homicide, especially in unplanned kills.
I mean, all of us get angry at time, don't we? But what stops us lashing out and killing someone? Well, we've all got a good frontal function, or at least I hope all of you have good frontal functioning, which tells you, no, don't lash out now. Count to 10, take a deep breath, step back a little bit. Let's think about this situation. Think of it as the guardian angel on behavior. But if, you know, the guardian angel is asleep, as it is in some murderers, well then, the devil can come out. People can get killed. There's two important caveats I want to make about these findings as an example. The first one is that it's more complex than that because not all murderers are the same. One of my murderers was a serial killer. Very nice man, Randy Kraft. He killed 64 people in a 12-year period just south of LA, almost without being caught. And in fact, Randy was very lucky to be caught. He was driving late on the freeway one night, and of all the stupid things he did, he made an illegal lane change. Anyone ever done that? Well, it was his unlucky night because the California Highway Patrol were right there. They needed to ticket someone. They pulled Randy over, and they only became suspicious when they found a dead body in the passenger seat. Bit of a giveaway. Otherwise, Randy could be out there killing even right now. But if you take a look at Randy's brain scan, that's the one in the middle, you can see it's different to the other two. Look at the very top, that's the prefrontal cortex. He's got good frontal lobe functioning. So that's one caveat. It's not one size fits all. Murderers do differ.
Brains are complex, and so are people. And you can't tell out of a brain scan who is a killer. But the quantitative comparison of brain scans does give an idea about which brain areas and brain functions can be associated with violent behavior.
It's a big nut to crack to stop violence and psychopathy. And if part of that is due to poor brain functioning and structure, what can we do to boost the brain to improve behavior?
Knowing the physically brain functions can be so strongly related to homicide and violence in general, how should we then treat criminals?
I think we've systematically failed to cure crime because we have ignored the biological part of the equation. There again, some people don't like the idea of biological interventions to change criminal offenders.
What sort of intervention could it be?
I mean, there's a lot of things we can do. I mean, the work I've been doing more recently has been giving better nutrition to kids, children, adolescents, and even adults to try and reduce aggressive and antisocial behavior.
I'll show you some data by Joe Hiblin. And what Joe did, he plotted seafood consumption as a function of homicide in 26 countries throughout the world. And yes, you see it, he got a chunky big correlation, pretty significant relationship. The more seafood you eat, the lower the homicide rate. Okay, and I know you're laughing at this because, you know, it sounds fishy, doesn't it? You know, more fish, you know, less homicide. And it's a correlation, and correlation is not causation. The only way, again, that we can prove causation is by doing randomized controlled trials, giving kids, adolescents, offenders more omega-3, and looking to see whether it changes their antisocial and aggressive behavior.
So far, I've completed 5 randomized controlled trials with omega-3, and I've been showing that it is effective at a modest level in reducing especially impulsive, aggressive behavior. It works with kids. It even works with young offenders in prison. You know, 3 months of omega-3 does make a difference. Why would it make a difference? Omega-3 is a long-chain fatty acid that's critical for brain structure and brain function. You know the membrane going around the cell? 35% of that membrane is made up of omega-3. Omega-3 enhances dendritic outgrowth. That's a technical term, but it's the connectivity of a brain cell with another brain cell. It regulates neurotransmitter functioning. It regulates gene expression. So, you know, the brain imaging research that we have done and others have done show that bad brain is associated with bad behavior. So taking that logic, the logic is if we can boost the brain, we can boost behavior and improve behavior. And I think one simple and benign way of changing biology is omega-3 supplementation.
So maybe by making more people take omega-3, we could reduce people getting killed?
Yes, I mean, I think the research is rather conclusively shown it does have an effect. Now, don't get me wrong, it isn't changing all of violence. It has a small, modest effect, but any effect, any improvement is better than nothing at all. And of course, violence is complex, you know? So one intervention, omega-3 supplementation, will make a little bit of a dent, but there's other factors to consider too. Here's one example. You know, research that I've been doing has shown, for example, that kids who have poor sleep at age 15 are more likely to go on to become criminal offenders 9 years later. Sleep. Well, you know what? We also know that offenders don't sleep well, and especially, guess what? They don't sleep well in prison. Because, you know, there's a lot of scary people in prison. Yet we believe that a lack of sleep will predispose to antisocial behavior. Why is that? Well, because the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is the guardian angel on behavior. It's involved in emotion regulation, impulse control. But if the prefrontal cortex is a little bit sleepy, you don't have that regulation on behavior. That's why we think a lack of sleep can predispose to crime. So, you see, if that's true, you think of teenagers. Are they getting enough sleep? No. And by the way, violence peaks at age 19. So all through the teenage years, those kids are not getting enough sleep, and it builds up. And I think it can explain why, you know, teenagers in particular can be impulsively violent. The intervention implication is, if we can give better education and even training programs for teenagers working with their parents to get more sleep, I think that could also make a dent in crime and violence.
Okay, so that's actually two...
pretty simple, straightforward things. But can we do it? You know, will people take omega-3 regularly? Will people take the educational advice on how to get a better night's sleep? You know, it's a bit like, we all know how to lose weight. Can we do it? No. I mean, I stuff myself with chocolate every night, and I've got 9 pounds to lose. You know, it's really hard. I know I can lose my weight by not putting the chocolate in my mouth, but I'm addicted.
Yeah, we all know this kind of problem.
Oh, don't we just. But we could also force people to take omega-3. By the way, I mean, in society, can we change the diets of kids at school by having more fish, for example, in their diet? Some people might object to that. But, you know, fish is good for you. You know, it has a lot of other, omega-3 has a lot of other benefits other than reducing impulsive aggressive behavior. So I say, why not? You know, why not better children who, some of whom could become the next generation of offenders? Another intervention, which is really fairly simple, mindfulness training. You know, getting a handle on our emotions, calming ourselves down. Because quite a bit of violence is spontaneous, emotional, impulsive violence, flying off the handle. Somebody said something that upset you. Mindfulness training can be very helpful in getting us to block out our angry thoughts, our angry feelings, and just focus instead on the here and now. Focus on our breathing. And simple training like that could also be helpful in reducing, especially, impulsive forms of violence.
Okay, but the people that you're treating, they have to want this treatment.
They have to want the treatment, that's true. And on the other hand, we tell offenders what to do. We tell them, go to prison. You know, we restrict their liberties very severely, don't we? So why shouldn't we tell them to do a bit of mindfulness training, get better sleep, take that omega-3. It might make all the difference. Because, you know, the problem is we throw them into prison, and what do? We're not really helping them. And, you know, I think you've got a good point. Do you mandate treatment on individuals? And even if the prisoners, they are people, they do have rights. I understand the argument that we shouldn't force people to be doing things. But I don't know how you think about it, because we don't push important programs, which could be successful in helping the person, if we don't push them on people who really need it, well, yeah, maybe they don't take it, and we just have you know, we live out the headlines that we live out today. In the future, that person will go on and still continue to be antisocial, psychopathic, violent. And yet we could have stopped it if only we'd pushed enough. But I do understand the ethical concerns of mandating treatment, even if it's as simple as having better health. Better health through better nutrition, better sleep, and better control over your thoughts and feelings. What's so awful and heinous on those sort of interventions? They change biology. Mindfulness upregulates the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that is deficient in antisocial and violent people. Why shouldn't we change the brain to change behavior?
Good question.
What would you say? What would be the arguments against? Come on, let's hear it.
What about can you inherit being a psychopath?
Absolutely.
Can it be in the genes?
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, are all brains then changeable?
Look, absolutely, there's a genetic basis, a significant genetic basis to crime, violence, and especially psychopathy. In terms of aggression and crime, 50% of the variation amongst us is due to our genes. You know, and also it's 50% environmental, but 50% is genetic. And we think with psychopathy, which is a more extreme type of antisocial criminal behavior, heritability can be even higher, up to about 60%. So yes, there is a significant genetic basis, but biology is not destiny. Even if there's a genetic basis to having, let's say, poor frontal lobe functioning, which leads to impulsive, aggressive behavior in part, we can still change the brain. We can still upregulate the brain of a person who, through their genes, through their bad genes, may have inherited poor impulse control, poor emotion regulation.
So there's still hope for...
There's hope for everyone, you know? nobody left behind, in my eyes, in terms of what we can do to try and do something about crime and violence in society. And we really should, because whether we're talking about domestic abuse, whether we're talking about rape, whether we're talking about paedophilia, bank robbery, or homicide, we need to do something about this. And I don't think we're doing enough.
The prefrontal cortex is one area of the brain which is shown to have an influence on violent behavior. Another area related to violence is the amygdala.
The amygdala is deep in the brain. And the other side to this is I want to talk about psychopaths. I think, as you know, psychopaths are criminal offenders who lack conscience, they lack remorse, they lack guilt, they lack shame. They don't experience the same emotions that we do. The question is why? We were interested in that, so we brain scanned 27 psychopaths, compare them to 32 non-psychopathic individuals.
Comparing the 27 brain scans of the psychopath with the 32 brain scans of the non-psychopath, they found that on the average, the psychopath had 18% volume reduction of the amygdala.
Okay, so that's telling us that perhaps structural impairment to the amygdala may be one of the reasons why psychopaths are so callous and so unemotional and are so lacking in empathy. Because the part of the brain critically involved in these emotions seems to be physically impaired. And if the emotional amygdala is burned out in psychopaths, then how moral is it of us to punish psychopaths as harshly as we do? Because, you know, psychopaths never ask to have, you know, an amygdala that's three sizes too small. They never ask for that.
The next question is, if the amygdala volume is strongly related to psychopathic behavior, violence, and homicide, can we then predict who is in the risk of committing violence later in life?
So this is a study I did with my colleague Dustin Pardini. We brain scanned young men in the community, aged about 18 to 21, and we measured the size of the amygdala, because we believed that reduced amygdala volume is a risk factor for future crime. And then we followed them up for 3 years and found out which ones had committed violence and how much. So we've got two groups, the young men with low amygdala volumes, the young men with high or normal amygdala volumes. And the key finding there is that the group with low amygdala volume, they have a 57% rate of violence 3 years after the scan, compared to the control group, where their rate of violence was 18%. So a threefold increase in rates of violence in these individuals. And that's controlling for background aggression and violence and psychopathy, which we assessed at baseline. So could it be that brain imaging is giving us some added value in our ability to predict who is going to be a risk for society?
If the brain scans, along with other risk factors, indicates that a person is predisposed to commit violence, can this person then get treatment?
We've gone decades saying we need to do more, but I think we're not. And I think the resources are not being sufficiently put in to the treatment and retraining of offenders in society, and especially the teenage kids who are showing delinquent antisocial behavior. You see, we care for kids who are depressed. We care for kids who are anxious. We care for autistic kids. But for an antisocial psychopathic kid, throw away the key, hang them high. We don't care about those nasty kids, do we? Oh, well, put it this way, I view delinquency and crime as a disorder, as a clinical disorder, just as depression and anxiety is a clinical disorder. Way back in 1993, I wrote a whole book on that one idea, that crime is a clinical disorder that needs treatment. You know what? That idea, that book went nowhere. It had no impact whatsoever. I was very disappointed, but I sort of understand it. We don't care for bad people. We care for people who are hurting, like depressed or anxious kids. But I think we need to reconceptualize this whole field and recognize that prisoners, even murderers and psychopaths, have a disorder, a clinical disorder beyond their control, and it needs help and treatment.
And there is treatment.
I think we could design more and new treatments. One of the problems is that we will fund research to treat depression. We'll fund research to treat anxiety. Will we fund research to treat aggression and violence? We have not. That's not our priority. And yet, so much harm and so much damage comes to society from those pathological forms of antisocial behavior.
What a good point.
Well, I've got one person converted here, but it's the rest of the world we need to convert.
Yeah.
Hopefully your podcast will do it.
I hope so. Okay, I think...
We're good?
I think we're good, yeah.
That's great, really, Sally. We had a good conversation.
It was a really good conversation. Good. I didn't ask any of my... only the first question, but that was enough.
That's great.
Thank you for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails Foundation. The music is originally composed by Hjalte Bisted Hjort, also known as Trumleorkestret. Find future episodes on scienceandcocktails.org or where you find your podcast. And if you like what you heard, please pass it on.